Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, everybody. We are back for yet another season. I am thrilled and honored that you're back tuning in again. And we have lots of exciting things to tell you about today. First, you might have noticed our new branding when you saw the show pop up in your feed today. That beautiful new logo design is by Andrew Tamlin, who is an incredible artist based in Greenville, South Carolina. You can follow Andrew's work on Instagram at formless.forming. And I think you'll be amazed at what you find there. Thank you so much, Andrew, for contributing in such a beautiful way to the show. Our first guest of the new season, season 7, is none other than Charlie Claire Burgess, who around these parts really needs no introduction, but who I will introduce to you in a moment. This will mark Charlie's third appearance on the show, and we've brought them back today to discuss their new book, Radical Tarot, Queer the Cards, Liberate Your Practice, and Create the Future, which will be published on September 26th by Hay House Publishing. You might have seen that we hosted a giveaway for the book on the In Search of Tarot Instagram, and that giveaway was in preparation for the launch of our new In Search of Tarot book club, which I am so excited about because if you've been listening to the show for any amount of time, you'll know what a voracious reader I am. And that's going to kick off this fall with Radical Tarot as our very first book club selection. So if you want to read along with us, order your copy today so that you can have it in hand by October 1st or be ready to purchase it when it goes on sale. And we'll be breaking the book up into sections for reading during the months of October, November, and December. So we'll finish this first book club selection by the end of the calendar year. And each month, we're going to release one episode of the podcast during which Angie and I will discuss that month's chapters just amongst the two of us. But if you're like me and you want to get in on the conversation and toss your own ideas around with other people, head over to patreon.com/insearchoftarot if you're not already a supporter of the show, and join us for as little as $2 a month, where we'll be hosting monthly Patreon-only book club hangs. Okay, now let me tell you about Charlie by way of reading their bio. Charlie Claire Burgess is a queer and trans non-binary tarot practitioner, writer, deck creator, and witch. They are the author of Radical Tarot, a guide to reading tarot radically for personal and collective liberation. The creator of Fifth Spirit Tarot, a queer and inclusive deck for a world beyond binaries, and the creator of The Gay Marseille, a cheeky queer update on the classic Tarot de Marseille. They are currently at work on their new book, Queer Devotion, which will be published by Hay House in 2025, and is an exploration of the queer divine in deities and figures of myth and legend. Originally from the Deep South, Charlie has made their home in Portland, Oregon, with their spouse and their one-eyed pug, Apollo. So I know that you're going to love this conversation. Angie and I actually both joined for this one. So it was a lot of fun to have the three of us tossing our ideas around. And Charlie is just such an incredible font of knowledge, but also such a wonderful, kind, generous human being. And I just am really thankful for everything they do, everything I've learned from them over the years, and everything they've contributed to this podcast over the years. So thank you so much, Charlie. Enjoy this first episode, everyone. And I hope that we will see you at a book club hang. Hope you'll grab your copy of Radical Tarot and read along with us. Tell anyone you know that you think would enjoy a tarot book club to hop in with us. And we'll see you next week.
So who am I outside of my bio? Well, this morning I gave my dog a bath. So I am a dog parent of a lovely one-eyed pug who has changed my life in just the month we've had him. I'm a queer person who's really interested in just the mystery, the liminal, the place of like gestation and possibility that we find in places like tarot, and also in other places like magic, like mysticism, all these things. Because I think that that's like a real core of where all change lies, is being able to like step into that middle place, or that maybe not middle place, but outer place, other place. And so I think that in pretty much like all of my work, even before I was in tarot and I was writing fiction, has all been kind of like gravitating or like orbiting around that sort of core question of just like seeking the mystery, you know?
Yes. I love that. I love that so much. And this is why I saved telling you, I was telling you before we hit record that I drew a card for the interview, and it is the Hanged One, which I feel like is exactly what you just described. Like, I think you literally describe in the book it as the other and the in between. And, you know, so this is why we love tarot and why we're here on the podcast today. Like, amazing, amazing. And I don't know that I knew. Did you write fiction before you got into tarot?
Yeah. I wrote short stories, so short fiction. I got my MFA in fiction writing. I always thought I was going to be a fiction writer, and I might still be. That's something I'm still interested in doing or trying to do. But surprisingly, all of this, all like the tarot stuff, the witchcraft stuff, that all really took me by surprise. You know, it's that wonderful thing about life where like I was always like, I'm going to be a published author, you know, I'm going to write books. I always thought that they would be novels or short story collections. And then nope, life was like, actually, you're going to write about tarot. And so it's really exciting that this is my first real, at least traditional publication. I've published self-published things before, like the first round of Fifth Spirit Tarot, the big Fifth Spirit Tarot guidebook. But this being my first like big publication is really kind of like a fulfillment of a dream I've had my whole life. But it's just happening in a way that like I never would have guessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love what you said about like, I never envisioned myself doing that, because I feel like that's a lot of us in the magical community are like, we didn't necessarily see ourselves like, none of us started off on a trajectory that as young children, or maybe some of us did, I don't know, I can't speak for everybody, but I feel like I would be somewhat surprised if I could see myself, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, and be like, I didn't see it that way, but like, you know, it kind of chooses you.
Absolutely. And I was, you know, at the same time as I never expected this, my current life is absolutely the life that like teenage me would have wanted for myself. Like teenage me would think that me right now is so cool, mm. You know, because I was, you know, super into, like the craft, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I was a little closeted Wiccan, you know, like I would have, teenage me loves this for me.
Yes. Yes.
But never considered anything like this as a real possibility, you know? So that's something I think I touch on in the introduction of the book is how sort of when life, you know, adult life, quote unquote, real life came in, I abandoned all that. Mm-hmm. I threw my tarot cards in a dumpster. I stopped believing in anything. I had like 10 solid years of being an atheist, kind of a wobbly atheist. I was also always like a little bit agnostic, but just, you know, complete, like just cynical, jaded. So when I was coming up with Radical Tarot, it was kind of a process of, I wanted to, just like the word radical says, I wanted to sort of get to some of the roots of the cards. So like in the book, I look at historical cards like the Tarot de Marseille. I look at like the Visconti cards, you know, we go back all the way to there and talk about, you know, where some of these images came from. And then from that, try to imagine what else these cards could mean, you know, like not what do they mean definitively, like textbook, what were they intended to mean from the very beginning of like the very first illustration of this card, but like what nuggets can we find in these images, in these quote unquote archetypes, and how can we work with those or change those in order to change the story, in order to change the narrative. I think that that's one of the really interesting things about tarot, and it's a danger and a blessing at the same time, is that depending on how we read the cards, they can either reinforce preconceived notions, internalized beliefs, conditioning, gender norms, you know, roles, things like that. Or they can give us opportunities to like identify those things and go, no, that's not what I want. That's not what I think is true. That's not, those aren't the rules of the world that I want to live in. And then we can actively work to change those things.
That's, I think that was really what I took away, or at least the impression that I had upon reading your book, was like, it seems very imaginative, and in the way that it allows the reader to kind of, even I think at the beginning of the chapters, you say like, this is the Hierophant. Here are some alternate names that you might name the Hierophant, or, you know, fill in your own or whatever. And what these, meanings have historically been, and then what you have the permission to do is to imagine new possibilities for these cards. And you do so, in a very like grounded and accessible way. And then you frame it alongside all of these other writers like Audre Lorde and, you know, these fantastic, these writers who are writing about like social justice or embodiment or liberation, and framing it alongside of, the like tarot, cards, which I think is incredible. And it makes me, I don't know. I think a lot of books that I read about magic, about the tarot, about like spirituality in general, just kind of put all of it in this like far cloud. And it just feels very far away. And how do you actually anchor it into your real life? And I really appreciated that about your book.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, I mean, it was Audre Lorde that said, who said the spiritual is political. And I really do believe that. I think that when we try to separate really, I think spiritual, because they are important, because they're like soul level important things like social justice, if we try to like separate those things from our spirituality, from our magic, like, first of all, why? Like, that stuff is, it's so important. It's part of the world that we live in. It's all of our responsibility and all of our reality. Like, the bifurcation of that has never made sense to me. And if we keep the spiritual and the magical only in this like bubble of either like abstract theory or just kind of like feel good, love and light stuff, or how do we get saved, you know, like salvation oriented stuff, then like, I mean, that's not real. Like, none of that is actually like grounded or rooted in our actual lives, our bodies, our day to day. Yeah. And so many of the, like when I read Audre Lorde, like it is a spiritual experience for me. Like some, like when I read José Esteban Muñoz, spiritual experience, you know, and these are philosophers or poets or essayists, but that's the stuff, when I read that, I get chills. I get like, you know, my mind opens.
Yeah. I mean, I could argue that like, because people have separated the spiritual from the real, that we are in this position that we're in globally right now, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love I think that's so important, you pointing out radical, the etymology of radical as being that rooted thing, because I think for me, at least, like I tend to think of radical people as being some kind of like way far off departure, you know, like far away place, but thinking of radicalness as actually being rooted, but also, as you were saying, like being rooted to the origin point of something which I think is more marginal, you know, like the origin place is being chaos or being, you know, sort of less codified, less dogmatic. And then from there, we as human beings kind of start to codify and categorize. But when we get back to the root, it's actually a lot more mysterious, you know?
Yes. Well said. Absolutely. The roots are nature, are natural, are animist. They're not artificial human categories. Absolutely.
But I think we tend to think of like research as getting to a definition point, which is like the opposite, I think, of the rootedness that you're pointing to, you know, which is fantastic. And something else that you just brought up that I wanted to kind of talk to you about, which actually, as you were saying it right now, it gave me a different sense of it, but I wanted to kind of talk about in the introductory chapter, I'm going to quote you to you. You say, quote, "As a tool of the margins, tarot helps us stand briefly outside our own lives, outside our conditioned beliefs and value systems, outside the false paradigms that we accept as truths, and examine them from new perspectives." And then in your chapter on the High Priestess, you talk about the trickiness of intuition, which is something that I think a lot about. And you say that it can, quote, "feel like a sense of knowing, but that feeling can too easily be conflated with learned conditioning, unconscious bias, and sociocultural programming." So this feels like a really marginal place, you know, juxtaposing these two quotes and these two thoughts, this place between using tarot as a gateway to kind of get outside of ourselves while also, for me at least, questioning whether that's even possible that we could ever get outside of ourselves. So I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about what you mean when you talk about using tarot in that way.
Yeah. So I think that that's what you're hitting on is part of the non-binary complexity of tarot and of just being a human.
Yeah.
You know, because that is exactly the thing. It's not possible to completely step outside of ourselves, not like while we're living in these bodies, at least, you know. There is no such thing as objectivity. The only thing that we can access as people is subjectivity. We can try to make that as non-biased as we can, but true objectivity is not possible. Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the things that tarot can help us do is really rigorously and compassionately examine ourselves, our beliefs, our decisions, the paradigm, like the things that we think are true that are leading us to make the decisions we are in our life or to behave in certain ways. And the on the flip side of that, the danger is that it also at the same time, as I said before, can just reaffirm those things. So I think it's a constant process. I don't think that, you know, it's something that like, that I can say I'm good at 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like something that you learn to do and then like, oh, done, never have to do that again. It's a constant process of self-evaluation, re-evaluation. In the justice chapter, I talk a little bit about morality and one of James Baldwin's essays where he talks about how it's necessary to constantly like reevaluate our morality, how there's no like stagnant morality. Everything has to be constantly examined and reexamined and examined anew and changed and scrapped and rebuilt. And, you know, and I think the same thing is true of tarot, which means that the archetypes, quote unquote, that we think we know aren't static things. The cards and the meanings we have for the cards aren't static things. There's no one correct meaning. You know, there's no definitive interpretation. So I think that if we can arrive at a place where it is oriented towards constant curiosity, you know, sort of resisting the urge to codify and define and even know exactly what a card means all the time, but instead orient it towards curiosity, experimentation, questioning, just sort of like radical openness, mm-hmm. then we can maybe get closer to something like, I don't know, true intuition, something closer to something like quote unquote divination. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even with like what we were talking about before with defining the cards, like that was kind of like a tightrope that I was walking when I was writing this book. Cause part of the point is like, I want people to investigate these cards for themselves. I want to open up a doorway so that people can find their own radical tarot. But at the same time, I do have to like talk about the cards, you know? Mm-hmm. So doing that in a way that is offering sort of like footholds or portals for people to continue their own self-examination while resisting really codifying it was something I was consciously trying to like sort of finagle for the mm-hmm. whole book.
Felt yeah. like you were doing that a little bit too with like, there were certain cards where you were talking about, I think it was in the Empress chapter, for example, where you were talking about like women and femme-identifying people and the harm that's been perpetuated on gendered people through the ages, and then also trying to liberate that card and what a difficult and tender thing that might be to try to undo, even in just like the few pages that you're trying to do it with this card, right?
Exactly. And I think that that's something that in the process of writing this book, I learned a lot about myself because I've been working on sort of degendering the tarot for myself since 2018 or something. Tarot actually walked alongside me on my own gender journey when I was figuring out that I was non-binary. And I think in the early stages of that, I was trying to just push away like all gender, just like, you know, be like, it has nothing to do with me. Like, go away. I don't want to see any gender in this at all. And in the process of writing this book, and also I think because I'm further along in my own transition, I actually got top surgery like 2 weeks after I turned in the manuscript for Radical Tarot.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
So I was like navigating the process of getting, you know, getting there, the medical system and everything as I was writing this book. Mm-hmm. And I think that I arrived in a place where I could actually be more open to the fact that like people have genders and that's fine. I think I used to hold any gendered anything at arm's length out of my own self-protection, you know? Mm-hmm. But when we look at something like tarot and we see so few cards in the deck have like feminine identified personages on them, that's like a meaningful thing. That's like a clue to something. Mm-hmm. Why is it all default male except for like these few cards? What kind of hints can that give us? What kind of like, as Jose Esteban Munoz calls it, queer evidence, can we follow there, you mm-hmm. know, that we can like listen to? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reading a book right now called Is Math Real? I hated math growing up. And this book is showing me like, and yet I've loved physics. I've loved reading about physics as an adult. And this book is like how I wish someone had taught me math, you know, and the possibilities of math. But one of the one of my favorite sections in it is saying, rather than asking why is this true about like 1 + 1 = 2, we can instead ask when is this true, you know? And like studying with Leah Garza over the course of this year and her Living Systems course also has really helped me think about there are many worlds within one world, you know? And so like you're saying with gender, like gender is both real and not real, you know, like, and the hanged one-ness of that, you know, like, and that you just like so many other things in our life, like we must grapple with this thing because it is real and in some worlds more than others and, you know, in different ways in different worlds, but it's like all simultaneously real and not real, you know, and important and not important. And I think like it really, I don't know how you feel, Charlie, but I feel like it shows myself a lot of compassion to allow myself to be both non-binary and acknowledge gender, you know, like that it's, you have to really be compassionate with yourself because it's out there. I mean, and it's so fundamental to the way our world is built, you know, like, so it's necessary. And it's, I think it's asking a lot of yourself to just like deny it or like ignore it or, you know.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I was treating gender as the problem or as like the culprit, when gender wasn't the problem. It's the norms, it's the roles, it's how our society and culture has like codified it into, you know, little paper dolls that we have to like act out, we have to assimilate to, or we're doing it wrong. So it wasn't ever gender. It was the norms. It was the roles. It is the binary. And so that perspective shift, has been really wonderful and really healing and opened up a lot of things for me. Like, I wasn't able to work with any, you know, deities or spirits who were strongly gendered before this process as well. And also I think that that's part of also my own transition is like, it's almost like I had to like free myself from it, from gender, from the boxes, in order to be able to come back around and start appreciating what gender can be for myself and for other people. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah,
totally.
It reminds me a little bit of like what, so I read the Emperor chapter, and I feel like it's not an uncommon thing for me to talk about the Emperor, and people say they don't really connect with the Emperor. I feel like that's everyone on some level, but it's interesting because I reflect back on when I was first learning the tarot, and I remember thinking like, this really doesn't feel like a lot of the attributes that are given to the Emperor are qualities that I saw in many of my mother figures, you know, that many of them were the, like the riverbank that everything flowed through. They provided the structure, they gave the walls, they gave everybody kind of like something to step on or foothold, as you said earlier. And it was interesting because I feel like I never connected with that card. And then someone, I don't even remember who, I think it may have been my dad who was teaching me that he kind of was the first person to say like, these are just qualities, you know, don't assign them to like, it has to be a man. It doesn't have to be this person or this just like stoic, rigid figure that you see painted on this card. And I think that was the first time that I ever had permission to think about it outside of the walls of like gender. But I really appreciated that chapter. In fact, I think I have it here where you said it was in reference. There was a quote that you gave from Yunka Porta, or I think their name is Tyson Yunka Porta, where he talks about like being in relationship to, like the Emperor being in relationship to what it is that he's tending rather than being a master of creation. And I loved that. That was such an important thing for me to read because that still is kind of a sticky card for me to relate to.
Absolutely. And with the Emperor, there's so much nurture in that card, like where there's so much potential for nurture, for ways to be nurturing, ways to be caring. In one of the, it's not the version of the Emperor that ended up in Fifth Spirit, but like the first version of that card that I drew was actually like of like a sort of farmer looking archetype, because one of the ways I think of the Emperor is as the caretaker, the custodian, the like you were saying, your analogy about the riverbank that like everything flows through is beautiful and perfect. Like, how can we provide nurturing structure to help, you know, the crops flourish? Like the Emperor is the trellis that the vine grows on, like, you know, grows onto to reach closer to the sun. Yeah. And we think of the Emperor so often traditionally as like the opposite of nurture, right? Like nurturing is the Empress's domain. But I don't think that's true. There's so much nurturing potential in that, in structure, in organization, stability, you know, all of these things can be really fruitful. Yeah. So it's about switching that perspective. And the Emperor was also, it was one of the hardest cards for me to work with. Emperor, Empress, and Hierophant. You know, I feel like those are like the big three that a lot of people struggle with, because gender norms and the church.
You know? Yeah. Do you want to, Angie, do you want to tell that story that you were telling me that kind of ties in with this?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I was reading the chapter on the Hierophant, and it made me laugh because that is very much like, you know, we have these figures that kind of represent these like boxes or the rules, and they're just hard and fast. There is no like flexibility to them. And it makes me think of this story that my husband's family has, where every holiday they would say to what they would make their Christmas ham, and they would say, don't forget to cut off the tip of the ham. And so they would do that for, you know, all of these kids are teaching these kids how to like make the Christmas ham, and it's like a family affair, but don't forget to cut off the tip of the Christmas ham. And they were like, why do we do that? And there were all these reasons for like, oh, it just doesn't taste as good, or it's too tough, or whatever. And they finally called the matriarch, who was like the elder, and like, why do we do this again? They were like, it's just because back then we didn't have a pan that was big enough. You know, like now you can just let the tip of the ham be. That was all, you know. And so it made me laugh because that's very much the moral of the story when it comes to the Hierophant for me, is like, why are we upholding these rules? Who are they serving? And how can we like change them to better fit like what our needs are in the moment, collectively and individually?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's hilarious. Thank you for sharing that story.
Listeners, just leave the tip of the ham alone.
that's absolutely right. Because at that time where that tradition started, there was a purpose. There was a reason. You couldn't fit it in the pan. Mm-hmm. But then as the pan grows, or as the oven, you know, gets bigger, then we reevaluate. We don't have to keep upholding the same rules or traditions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, and one of the things that I talk about in the Hierophant chapter is belief. Why are we believing in what we are believing in? I think that when we believe in something to the extent of like faith, you know, when we believe in things incredibly strongly, that demands and requires a real inquiry, like real investigation, real, you know, radical getting to the roots of like, why, mm-hmm. you know, like, so I'm interested in doubt as an expression of belief, of faith. Mm-hmm. I think that so often when people talk about faith, what they really mean is just a closed mind, an inability to countenance anything or hear anything different, you know, and, yeah. and being completely closed off to challenges of it. But if you really had faith in something, you would be able to be open to challenging it, you know?
Yeah, I have to recommend the book, The Faith to Doubt by Stephen Batchelor. If you've ever read Stephen Batchelor, that's a book that I take on trips. Like, it's not very long, but like basically the entire book is one long highlight, you know, and just that question, or just that phrase, the faith to doubt, you know, like, and how much faith it does take to doubt. And along those lines, I wanted to ask you, Charlie, how you feel about, or how you've experienced, like, in the tarot community or the astrological community, which are, you know, paths that have a lot of tradition, different traditions attached to them, and different longstanding beliefs or, you know, dogmatic beliefs. How has it felt for you to question those things? How have you experienced the act of questioning in those spaces? I know that for me, over the years, I've been really surprised by how like dangerous it feels if I even ask a question, and how people seem to conflate the asking of a question with disrespect, which I really do not think that they are linked. I don't find it disrespectful to simply like ask a question, you know, like, in fact, I actually find in a way it being respectful because I care enough to like dig into the thing and like try to get deeper into it. But I'm curious, like, how that's been for you.
I have always been a questioner, kind of like a devil's advocate almost. Like, I was the most annoying kid because, like, not only would I ask why, I would, like, then, you know, I would mount a challenge, you know. I would try to poke holes in all of the answers, sometimes just because I was a contrary person. I still am kind of a contrary person. So like, that's one of the things that drove me from any sort of belief system or spirituality initially, because like in high school when I was into Wicca and stuff, eventually, even then, I was like, I'm not really into this God goddess thing. Like, what's up? Like, why is the gender roles there? I didn't even have the words for it yet, like to articulate what it was about that I wasn't loving, but it was the binary gender norms, present in not all Wicca today, but in like the Wicca that I had access to, in like the early 2000s, and and also growing up in the Christian church, like there was no room for questioning. There was no room for any deviation of belief. And so then I was just like, screw it, like science only, you know. But even that, like what is science if we're not constantly questioning and reevaluating? Like what else has science proven other than that what we think we know right now is going to be like exploded down the line, and so when I started entering like the witchy and spiritual spaces again, like I kind of at that point had lost my tolerance for not questioning, for like, you know, I like went into it knowing like being automatically suspicious of any dogmatic belief, automatically suspicious of anything that was presented as fact but was not like backed up with sources. So like when I was getting back into tarot, for example, I had like the hardest time finding any tarot sources that I could actually like believe in or trust, because so many of the guidebooks that I could find, people were saying, here's what this card means, and not saying why, period. Because I was kind of like, why? But why does it mean that though? Where is this coming from? Like, what other books are you getting this from? Or like, show me your reasoning at least, you know? And so I think that when we get afraid of asking questions, or when people react in strongly negative ways to being asked questions, often I think it comes from a place of fear. It comes from, you know, cancel culture, quote unquote. Everybody's afraid of getting destroyed because they've done something wrong, or because their system, the system that they're using, is, you know, has XYZ problem with it. Like, and I'm interested in what could we do instead of that? What, how can we love a system and expose its flaws and love it so much that then we can work to change those things, to rectify those things, to, you know, to heal those harms.
It's like a real winding. There are so many, like, I think that the fear that people feel is that it's not straightforward, and so much of it is up to their own creation and understanding themselves on a very intimate level. And it's like the question itself is not a disrespect. It's like a love language, you know, to want to understand you is such an intimate act. And I think that's, it takes a lot of work too. I think there's so much like imagination and labor that one has to do, but it is, I mean, I think Nick and I were kind of touching on this yesterday in our conversation of like, that is the magical path. The magical path is queer. The magical path is liminal, and it is, highly, highly moldable.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's what's helped me the most, like with the, when talking about the margin and using the margin as a talisman, like you said, like, you know, if I know that the margin or chaos is the origin point, and I don't really like to use the word truth, but like, if there is such a thing as that, like that's the margin to me, which is like unknowable. So like, that's what I have to really rest into, is like underneath all of these questions is no answer, you know, like is there is no answer, you know, like, and I mean, that's like, and that's a lot for people to take. And that's not a convenient on a Wednesday night when you're tired from work and you just want to like, you know, whatever, like, you know, but, and I understand that. I understand we all have different, you know, capacities for holding ambiguity and paradox at different points in our lives. But like, anyways, let's move on because we're running long and I want to get to the court cards, because the court cards are, speaking of difficult to understand parts of the tarot, are really hard for a lot of people. So I really like that you titled your court card section, "The King is Dead, Long Live the Blank." And you discuss the reasons that the court cards can feel so difficult to connect with and have been so confusing for so many people, and also the different approaches that different creators and writers have tried to take to like branch away from those problematic aspects, and how that has or has not always, you know, worked as well as others. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that and about how you have approached the court cards.
Yeah, totally. So the way that I work with the court cards myself is as sort of like embodiments of the energy of the suit that they're in. They show us like different ways to interact with or embody their suit energy. So I renamed the court cards. Well, I offered potential renamings of the court cards in a way that attempts to, you know, take out the imperative gender of them. I believe that all of the cards are genderless and genderful. They can have any gender we want them to, but there's no implicit gender in any of the cards. And it is helpful to remove the gendered names from the cards, I think, because of, you know, when you're dealing with a system that has page, knight, queen, king, and the queen is always the emotional card, and the king is like the top dog, most powerful authority card, like it's just reinforcing gender roles and why. So I offered some different renamings, and because I am just like a slut for alliterations, I did student, seeker, sage, steward. So I called the pages students, the knights seekers, the queens sages, and the kings stewards. So with the pages, for instance, renaming the page as student is something that I is really close to like my practice, because I think of pages as learners. They're learning how to work with their suit. They ask us to like occupy a place of curiosity and open-mindedness in the realm that they are in. So like page of wands, for instance, would be getting curious with how we're working with that fire element in our lives, our passion, our lust, like whatever it is. And at the same time, we tend to think of students or learners as being the bottom of the, like, you know, the bottom of the ladder. If we are in a place of learning, then we are not an expert. We're like lowly. But what I think is really important about sort of reshuffling the court cards is realizing that that page space, that student space, isn't the lowest at all. In fact, I'm interested in a non-hierarchical court cards system, but if anything, like the page is the most necessary of all, because we need to, it's kind of like emblematic of that liminal marginal space of open-mindedness and questioning that I'm arguing is what we need to bring to the tarot every time we shuffle, you know? Every time we shuffle, we're entering that page student space. If our leaders our authority figures are not questioning, are not learning, are not open-minded to change, to other perspectives, that's when we enter authoritarian land, fascism, you know, abuses of power. So really, like, that student space is like the heart of tarot, I think, for me. And then I was also interested with, like, the queens, for instance. You know, the queens are often chalked up to being emotional, to being either the emotional card of the court cards or the nurturer of the court cards. And as we already touched on before with the Emperor Empress, I think that each one of these cards is showing a different way of nurturing. You know, every single one of these cards is nurturing in some way or another. The kings, which I renamed stewards, that's a way of nurturing the land, nurturing whatever is underneath the umbrella of your care. And as is learning, curiosity, that's another way of nurture. The seekers for the knights, they're pursuing what they believe in. They're moving through the world, taking action for what they believe in. That's care. That's nurture. You know, so I wanted to take some of those things out of only being the domain of, like, one card. Mm-hmm. And for the queens as sages, I think the real meaty part of the queens for me is their wisdom. And that's not just emotional wisdom. That's not just intuition. It's wisdom. It's also life wisdom, you know? It's being able to occupy that sort of wise mind space, which is a term that I use in the book that comes from dialectical behavioral therapy. It's the place where the intuitive, emotional, well, not intuitive, the space where the feelings, the feeling mind and the thinking mind overlap. And that's the realm of intuition, according to DBT. That's the wise mind space. It's not just emotion. It's not just feeling. It's both. It's emotion and feeling, and it's the mind and it's thinking, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, lots of thoughts about the court cards, but yeah, I wanted to open up their gendered boxes, and also, challenge the hierarchy of them. Yeah.
And I really like that you said, that you wanted to allow different aspects to permeate, like, all of them, you know, that, like, because that's something I feel like with tarot and astrology and different, you know, there's so many different systems. Like, when we really categorize or, like, try to, like, be like, this is this, and this is this, and this piece of myself is this, and this piece of myself is this. I mean, that's not really how it works. Like, you know, the way that we go through our life is so, like, interrelated and interlaced, and it's not, there aren't, like, these clear definitions and boundaries between each, like, little piece of ourselves. So I like that you are letting those walls kind of flow and fall down a little bit, you know?
So Charlie, there's, like, this book is, it's, as I said, it's very, like, grounded, but also, oh, it's a book that opens up possibility for the reader. And it's a, like, wellspring of information, like your bibliography is so dense. And that's, like, one of the first things that I do whenever I get a new book, I actually jump to the back because I love seeing what was used and referenced in the books. But for the tarot newbie, what is a piece of information that you might give them? Because it's like, you know, it's a long and winding road, and each of us has our own path with tarot that is long and winding. But what would you give to the new person, new practitioner?
I would say, what would I say? I would tell a newcomer to tarot to forget everything that they think they know, to resist definitions, to resist trying to, like, memorize card meanings, and instead just to get real curious. You know, I think that reading tarot books is important, but I think that so many people, when they first start reading tarot, including myself at one point in time, just want to know, what does this mean? you know, they want to like have the answers for what the cards mean. And then they want those cards every time they pull them to give them like the answers, you know, like the big answers to all the things. And that's like not at all what tarot does. Tarot mm-hmm. gives you more questions than it does answers. And that's kind of the point. So I would say resist answers and welcome questions.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. So Charlie, we always wrap up our conversations here with a last question, which is, what are you in search of right now in your life?
I think that right now I'm in search of like peace, which sounds like a silly or basic answer. But I think that I've spent so many years like almost glorifying struggle. And now I'm just trying to find ways to prioritize peace and joy, which is not the same thing as like refusing struggle. It's not the same thing as not being involved. It's not being apolitical, but it's, you know, finding ways to cultivate just like a sense of joy, but like centered, calm joy. Like it's a peaceful flavor of joy that I'm trying to cultivate or search for in my life right now.
Yeah. I get that. I don't think that's a silly wish at all. That is not easy and so important. Yeah.
If I had just put the word world there though, it would have been just the basic beauty pageant answer. What are you in search of? World peace.
Oh man.
That would be nice too.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you for this conversation. Will you tell everybody how they can find you and follow you, where they can purchase your book? And also, I don't know if it's still possible for people to support the Gay Marseille, but you can talk about that too. Just anything and everything you want to share with everybody.
Yeah. Well, the best way to follow along with what I'm doing would be on Instagram, where I am the.word.witch. Or my website, which is thewordwitchtarot.com. And on my website, you can sign up for my newsletter and make sure that you hear about all of the things, such as when the Gay Marseille is available to order. Right now the Kickstarter is already closed. At some point I'll, you know, have pre-orders open for that deck, and then, you know, I'll be selling the extra copies that I have. So if you want to stay in the loop for that, newsletter is the best place. And on my website, you can also find links to all the places, not even all the places, some of the places you can buy Radical Tarot, or you can buy it from me, which would also be appreciated. It's going to be available pretty much everywhere worldwide. So ask your local bookstore to stock it.
And that publication date is September 26th, I believe, correct? And we will start reading for our book club, our new book club, on October 1st. So I hope everybody listening will get the book and read along with us. I'm super excited for that. And to dive in, having read it once, now I'm excited to go back and like read in chunks and like have a little bit more focused like discussion around it. And yeah, I'm super excited for that. So thank you again, Charlie, for this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's birdgerhl_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.